Welcome to the President's Inbox, a CFR podcast about the foreign policy challenges facing the United States. I'm Jim Lindsay, Director of Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. This week's topic is Africa's reaction to the Russian invasion of Ukraine. With me to discuss how Africa is responding to the Russian invasion is Ebenezer Obidari. Ebenezer is the Douglas Dillon Senior Fellow for Africa Studies at the Council. He is the author and editor of numerous books, most recently Christianity, Sexuality, and Citizenship in Africa. His forthcoming book, due out in September, is Pastoral Power, Clerical State, Pentecostalism, Gender, and Sexuality in Nigeria. He blogs regularly on the Africa in Transition blog, available on CFR.org. He's had two pieces recently on Africa's reaction to the Russian invasion of Ukraine, one entitled Analyzing the Russia-Ukraine Conflict from an African Standpoint, and the other, Russia's Invasion of Ukraine May Drive a Wedge Between the West and Africa. Ebenezer, thanks for joining me.
Thank you, Jim.
Ebenezer, I'd like to begin with just having you give us an overview of how countries in Africa have reacted to the Russian invasion of Ukraine.
Thank you. That's an interesting question. So the overall reaction has been quite a surprise to many people, in the sense that whereas many people expected African countries to jump on the Western bandwagon to condemn Russia and to pitch their tent with the United States and its Western allies, things have not exactly lined up, you know, that way. Several countries voted to abstain from the UN resolution condemning Russia. More than eight countries decided not to vote at all. A few countries voted for Eritrea, at least voted for Russia. So there's been a lot of surprise because things haven't exactly aligned with the way that people expected African countries to vote.
Well, help me explain why that's been the case, Ebenezer, because very early on, the Kenyan permanent representative to the United Nations, Martin Kamani, gave a very powerful speech denouncing what the Russians had done, pulling no punches and decrying Russian aggression, and he forcefully rejected irredentism and expansionism on any basis, including racial, ethnic, religious, or cultural factors. But African capitals haven't followed up on that strong denunciation. Why?
You're absolutely right. Representative Martin Kimani did indeed speak very strongly against irredentism. But part of that speech, you know, the more interesting aspect of that speech is the way he also edged his bet. The way he said, look, we understand that there shouldn't be irredentism, but people should also understand that the borders that African countries inherited, you know, from colonialism were imperfect borders. So while Kimani was speaking firmly against irredentism, he was at the same time flagging some of the issues that several African countries have rallied around as their own frustration with respect to the way they've been treated by Western countries in the past.
Now, as you described it, African countries sort of fell into different camps. You had something on the order, I think it was 28 African countries that voted in favor of the March 2022 UN General Assembly resolution demanding that Russia immediately, completely and unconditionally withdraw from Ukraine. You had 17 African countries that abstained. That's about half of the abstentions
yes.
on the measure overall. And there were, I think, eight African countries that didn't bother to vote.
Mm-hmm.
Anything you can tell us about why some countries were in one group versus another? I know you mentioned Eritrea a moment ago. There, clearly, it seems to be the case that the leader of Eritrea has close personal ties to Putin.
Yes. So the case of Eritrea is very clear. It will have been a surprise if Eritrea had voted to condemn Russia. Eritrea has to be, you know, one of the least democratic states, if not in Africa, you know, probably in the entire world. So it was clear the way Eritrea was going to go.
Well, I know that Eritrea joined the company of Belarus, North Korea, Syria, and of course, Russia in voting against the resolution.
And in the case of those countries, right, these are very authoritarian states. So really no surprise there. And if you look very closely as well, there really, you know, has been no surprise with South Africa, right? South Africa feels that it has an obligation to Russia because of the support that the Soviet Union rendered to the African National Congress during the era of apartheid. And it's been consistent. So you, again, no surprise. Or with Zimbabwe, which has come under Western sanctions, or with, you know, Yoweri Museveni in Uganda, Nigeria has been a little bit of a surprise. Many people expected, and Nigeria actually did vote to condemn Russia. But having done that, the country has literally, you know, fallen into, you know, this diplomatic silence. So in some of those instances, we got what we expected. In the case of a country like Nigeria, you know, it's been a little bit of a surprise.
Well, obviously, you know a lot about Nigeria, Ebenezer. Why do you think it is that the government in Nigeria has been silent on the issue?
It's been a head scratcher for me. So the foreign minister, you know, even after Nigeria had voted in support, you know, the first time to condemn Russia, was, you know, asked by, you know, reporters in the country and said, look, could you please expatiate on why, you know, despite the vote against Russia, you know, Nigeria has not actually come out strongly, nothing at the level of the kind of speech that Martin Kimani delivered at the United Nations, something to show that Nigeria is indeed exercising a leadership role, you know, on the continent. And that has been a surprise. And I think that there's a way in which the Nigerian reticence sort of codifies the reticence that you find across other, you know, across the rest of Africa. The perception that, and as I mentioned in the piece I wrote for, you know, for my blog post, the perception that African countries have been inferiorized by the West, the perception that Western countries' rhetoric has not always matched, you know, their action, and the perception that Western countries expect African countries to sit when they're asked to sit and to stand when they're asked to stand. I think a little bit of that, some of those cross currents have converged, you know, in the Nigerian reaction.
So you're telling me that in Nigeria and other countries in Africa, they're angry over perceived slights, hypocrisy on the West, and they're taking it out on Ukraine?
Absolutely. I think there's a little bit of that. A little bit of wanting to rub the nose of the West in it. And I think it's also important to, you know, while we're at it, think about the context in which the Ukrainian conflict has broken out. Part of what I think has been missing from the conversation so far, you know, as far as I'm aware, is the conversation that has been going on within African universities, you know, African think tanks, around what is broadly regarded as decolonization. This idea that, you know, Western ideas, Western epistemologies, you know, and Western ways of doing things have become regnant and dominant in Africa, and that it is about time that space was created for the emergence of what is broadly called indigenous ways, you know, African ways. Regardless of the merit of that, and we can talk about that later, regardless of the merit of that movement, that upsurge, I think it's important not to miss that it's part of what I think philosophically is driving, you know, this reticence that we see on the part of, you know, of African countries. So it makes it all the more interesting that over the last 5 years, African countries have been saying that Africa should be taken more seriously, African agency should be taken more seriously in international diplomatic circles. And then you have a war that appears to be, on the surface, a war between two European countries. And it's on the back of that, that this reticence is coming out, you know, where people are saying, you know what, for once, let's see them duke it out and not get us involved in it, because they've not been listening to us. Because in the past, when we've had our own legitimate grievances, the tendency has been for those grievances to be swept under the carpet because Western countries are only interested in themselves, in their own interest.
I want to get to this question about the consequences for Africa and what it means. But before we get to that topic, just one last question on the reaction here. And that is, to what extent is the African reaction, particularly from the countries that have been overtly critical as opposed to silent on what the West has been done, really been driven by autocrats backing other autocrats? And your two blog posts on this, you mentioned the reaction in Uganda, with the president of Uganda, Mr. Museveni, who has been quite critical. I will also note that he has been in office for 3 decades now. So how much of this is simply one autocrat scratching another autocrat's back?
I think it's a mix of both. So there is the legitimate grievance, which I'm hoping that people would actually pay attention to, because not every leader or not every analyst that is, you know, bringing those grievances to the table is a charlatan, right? So that's important. Some of those things I've just tried to articulate. But there is also the, you know, don't interfere in our policy stance of someone like Museveni, which essentially boils down to, I'm going to be a dictator, you know, for the next 2,000 1,000 years, and then I'm going to hand over to my son who is going to rule for another 1,000 years. So there's a little bit of political opportunism there, and I think it's important to emphasize that as well.
How much of it has also been the fact that Russia has been proactively courting leaders in Africa? I note that there has been increased presence of Russian mercenaries, the Wagner Group, in various countries in the Sahel. Sort of walk me through that. Help me think about the Russian presence in Africa.
That's a very important point. So for the most part, when we've thought of foreign interference in Africa, especially over the past couple of decades, most of the time we've thought of China. And for good reason. The China Belt and Road Initiative has been one of the most interesting developments. I mean, not just in an African context, but in a global southern context over the last 2 decades. But what I think has happened, the more we focus on China, is that the less we focus on other actors, you know, that have taken an interest in Africa over the last, you know, 2 decades. And this is not just Russia. India has been quietly exerting influence in Africa over the last 10 years, at least. Turkey is, you know, becoming a major player in the Horn of Africa and in other parts of the continent. So I think the larger point is there is that we've sort of focused most of our attention on China as we should, but all this while we've allowed, you know, Russia to basically fly under the radar. And what Russia has done, you know, is to sort of exert an influence in all those countries, almost behind the backs of, you know, of everyone.
How much of this reaction in Africa that you're seeing, where there's in some sense, what I guess the Germans would call it Schadenfreude, sort of taking delight at the misfortunes of the West, is embraced by publics across Africa as opposed to leaders?
That's a great question, because it's also one of the most interesting developments of on account of this crisis, which is what you might call the, you know, the more or less the divide between the African leaders and the people of Africa. So one instance I mentioned in, you know, one of the 2 pieces I wrote is the example of young Nigerians who responded to President Zelensky's call, you know, for everybody to come and help. And, you know, they went to the Ukrainian embassy in Abuja, the Nigerian capital, and they said, you know, sign me up. You know, I want to be part of this fight. I think for many of those people, not all of them, you know, by any means, but for many young people, there is the understanding, you know, that what is at stake is not just a war between 2 European countries, it's a war between 2 philosophies of governance, 2 governance models. On the one hand, there is the authoritarian model that is, you know, symbolized by Mr. Putin and Russia. And then on the other hand, there is the West. And as far as we know, young people, you know, because of the way, especially that they voted with their feet over the last 3 decades, you know, because of the way they've reached, you know, they've come to the West, you know, whether you're talking about the United States, you know, Canada or Scandinavian or Central, you know, continental Europe, they realize that what is at stake is a quote unquote clash of civilizations. And for many of those people, they want to vote for the West as opposed to their leaders who, for their own narrow political and economic interests, want to back Russia. So that divide between the people and government in Africa, it's a very important element of this, you know, of this conflict.
Let's talk a little bit about the potential consequences here. And I'm wondering, Ebenezer, in your sense, if you think that African countries, by choosing either to sit on the sidelines or to be critical in the West, are jeopardizing their longer-term interests. And I ask in part because you mentioned at the beginning that Africa has a stake in legitimizing the principle that borders are sacrosanct, that sovereignty should prevail, precisely because many countries are unsatisfied or dissatisfied with the boundaries and borders they inherited from the colonial powers. And the sort of implicit agreement across Africa has been, we don't like them, but we'll accept them because the alternative is even worse.
Yeah.
Aren't they in danger of basically endorsing, even implicitly, a principle they would not want to live with?
Absolutely. There's a piece I just finished, you know, where I'm basically making this point, where I'm saying that Africa should be wary of cutting its nose in order to spite its face. And that I see the danger of that happening. And I think one of the disappointing, you know, aspect of this is the way in which a country like Nigeria, you know, an economic, you know, power on the continent, has refused or basically has ceded leadership to South Africa on this matter. I think it's important for African countries to be able to hear their grievances against the West, to speak about, you know, their own founders' wishes to have a reorganized international, you know, political order. And to talk talk about the way in which Western countries have not always, you know, followed up on their own moral rhetoric in the past. These, as I've said earlier, are quite legitimate grievances. As a matter of fact, it's not only African countries that have expressed those grievances. Southeast Asian states have, you know, this is something that resonates across the global South. If you have your ears close to the ground in Latin America, you hear the same kind of talk. Having said that, it's important that African countries, I think, also realize that what it will mean to back Russia, because this is not just another fight. This is not just two European countries duking it out. This is one country violating the territorial integrity of another country. And if there is any region in the world, you know, that should have a moral stake in that and that should understand the long-term consequences of that, it is African countries that have always pleaded legitimately that kind of thing has always been allowed to happen to them. So my hope is that in the long run, African countries sort of overcome their reticence for those who are reticent. And for those who don't seem to, you know, want to show their hands, I think it's important that they show their hands and, you know, they join the West and the United States in what I think is a very clear moral conflict between two opposing philosophies of governance.
What about the economic dimension of all of this, Ebenezer? I mean, many people, when they approach the analysis of world politics, basically follow the idea of follow the money. They would say, who's trading, who's investing? On that score, Russia's a relatively minor player on the African continent. I think the level of investment is somewhere around $7 billion on an annual basis. If you look at the West, the number is six or seven times that. And then, of course, when you get to issues of official development assistance, the West is far more generous and has invested far more in Africa than Russia has. Are African countries at risk potentially of alienating a main source of economic support?
I think they are. I think, you know, so you can think about the economic consequences of the conflict in at least two ways. One is separating between the immediate economic effect of the crisis from the aftershock of COVID. I think, you know, one thing that has sort of fallen through the cracks, as we've spoken about, as people are focused on Ukraine, is COVID-19, which devastated, you know, African economies, and the impact of which for many of those countries, you know, is still, you know, we still don't understand. So that's one thing. But the other thing, as you've said, is I think it's also important for African countries, you know, to realize that their long-term economic interest, you know, aligns with Western economic interest. The amount of trade that continues to go on, you know, small and medium, you know, medium-scale enterprises between African countries and Western countries far exceeds whatever it is that, you know, those countries, you know, have, you know, with Russia. African countries, especially those, you know, that are, you know, oil producing countries, continue to have relationships, you know, with the United States, you know, with European countries. Young people in Africa, you know, there are parts of Africa that are now the hub, you know, of, you know, financial and technological, you know, startups. In most of those places, the young people, those at the head of those startups, want to reach out to, you know, Western entities and Western governments. So I agree with you that long term, you know, the interest of Africa, the economic interest, is best served by aligning with the West as opposed to an alignment with Russia, you know, that at the end of the day is still, economically speaking, a minor player on the continent.
Well, let's talk about how the West should respond to the resentment that many African countries feel, and it is coming to the fore in the debate over how to respond to Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Perhaps we should begin with what you think Western countries shouldn't be doing. In one of your recent blog posts, you were quite critical of the speech that the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, Linda Thomas Greenfield, gave. What did she say, and why do you think it was tone deaf?
I think it was during the BBC, an interview with a BBC correspondent, and she was asked about the reticence of some African countries. And I think she said, well, we're going to have to talk to them because they need to understand, right? They need to understand that there are no neutrals. There can't be neutrals in this fight. And while I understand, you know, where the ambassador was coming from, you know, I was making the point that I stoned her because she came across as peremptory, as imperials, and basically echoing the very sentiment that many African countries, you know, have been complaining about. And I think that it's one of those, the things that the United States and the West need to think about is the language of communication, right? Understanding that the grievances, you know, that some of which I've enumerated are quite legitimate, and doing their best not to fall back into the same hole, you know, in which, you know, they found themselves in the past.
So what would that language sound like? How do you talk about what the West regards rightly in my view, as the moral imperative to stand up to Russian aggression in a way that doesn't create this sense of hubris and paternalism that you sense or fear.
It could go something like this. This is a very clear moral fight. South Africa under apartheid was also a clear moral fight. We dropped the ball. Many of you are still angry about Libya and Mr. Gaddafi. We felt that he was a dictator, but we really should have worked more with regional allies to find a way, you know, to get him out of the door. Oh, by the way, it is true that we've not always spoken to you as fully conscious moral agents in the international system. We get that. And from now on, we're going to be doing our best to not do what we've been doing in the past. A word that I think has, you know, has sort of become gained currency in the United States in the media over the last, you know, 5, 6 years is the word listening. And without prejudice to the way different ways in which it's used in within the American media, I think it's one thing that the United States especially needs to do more of over the coming years. Having said that, and this is, I think, it's a crucial element. Having said that, I'm by no means advocating that the West should retreat from its own values, right? I think it's actually more important that the West doubles down on those values. What people want, I think, is just more sincerity. To say, okay, if this rule applies to agent A, it applies equally to agent B, and it applies at all times to both agent A and B. What I think people have perceived in the past is that, and I think, I mean, just think about the way the United States, you know, reacted, you know, when Mobutu was leader in Zaire, which is now Democratic Republic of Congo. You know, it's a dictator, but it's our dictator. People no longer want a situation where, you know, the West world, when its interest, you know, is affected, you know, say, oh, yeah, you know, remember those principles that we were talking about yesterday? They no longer matter. And then tomorrow to say, oh, remember those principles? We are now going to live and die by those principles. I think more moral consistency, you know, greater transparency, but also greater fidelity to those principles. Because as I said earlier, even if some, you know, African leaders try to like to play havoc with those rules, majority of people on Africa, especially young people, recognize that those values are salient, that they are universal, and, you know, they just want greater adherence and fidelity to them.
I suspect at least some of the people listening to our conversation, Ebenezer, would be scratching their head, not because of the litany of mistakes or sins the West committed that you've just recited, but they would say that's only half of the balance sheet. On the other side, Western countries have been incredibly generous, provided a lot of foreign aid, have helped Africa deal with the AIDS epidemic, investing in other global health initiatives. Why doesn't that factor into this conversation?
That's absolutely true. But people would also say we can walk and chew gum at the same time. And this is what I was saying earlier about, you know, the piece I just wrote, in which I'm basically asking African countries to be careful not to cut their, you know, their noses in order to spite, you know, their faces. Which is that on the one hand, those grievances ought, you know, to be tabled and people ought to listen, as we've just said. But at the same time, it's important to keep in mind, you know, that, you know, the values that the West represents are indeed universal values, and that on its best day, the West has defended those values very fervently and vehemently, if not in Africa, at least in other parts of the world. So I agree with you. It's important as we move along, especially over the next, you know, 3 or 4 weeks, as we enter the most crucial parts, you know, of this conflict. And I'm hoping that the diplomatic onslaught that, you know, the West is going to engage in Africa will at least reference, you know, some of, you know, what you've just mentioned. That, look, we're not all bad, which is true, right? We've helped build schools. We've helped strengthen the rule of law. We've helped promote social justice. We've helped, you know, organize elections. All those things are good things. You have immigrants from different parts of Africa who are doing very well in the United States, in Western countries. Your interests are our interests. Our interests are your interests. So I think there is no contradiction in saying both of those things at the same time. Talking about those grievances on the one hand, and talking about the very fantastic and absolutely wonderful things that Western countries have done on the other hand.
Let me try out a little bit more on that, Ebenezer, because I think it's a fascinating vein of conversation. And as you look at Africa, do you think there are particular countries the United States should be focused on, the West should be focusing on? Again, to this point, we've talked about Africa. Africa as a continent, but obviously tremendous diversity across the continent. Are there countries that should be a focus of diplomacy because they might lead others? Or should we not be talking to governments at all, but perhaps be talking to people? How do you think about that?
So there are two answers to that. One, I'm going to betray my bias by saying that Nigeria is absolutely important.
Okay, we should declare you are from Nigeria. You were born in Nigeria.
Yes, I'm originally from Nigeria. Yes, but a country of more than 200 million people, an economy powerhouse,
most populous country in Africa,
with the potential, you know, to play the role of economic, political, and diplomatic leader. So absolutely, the United States should be talking to Nigeria, but that's on the one hand. But you mentioned something else, which I think is extremely important, that it's not just the states, you know, that, you know, or the political leaders that the West should focus on. That broad sphere called civil society, populated by all kinds of, you know, community-based organizations, civic associations, the media, you know, different, you know, professional interest groups, that's where the United States should focus more of its attention for at least two reasons. As I said, if you really want to measure the temperature, the political temperature in Africa, that's where you go. You don't go to the state. That's where you get your most accurate measurement. That's number one. Number two, that's the engine of democracy. The push to have a fair and transparent system, to have the rule of law respected, to have elections, you know, that are sacrosanct, to build prosperous, solid democracies. The push has come from that sphere of society consistently over the last, you know, 40, you know, 50 years. And long term, I think that's where the United States and indeed other Western countries, that's where they should focus their interest.
How much of that should be done by Western diplomats or official government organizations? And how much of that, Ebenezer, is something that should be conducted by civil society organizations in the West?
I think it should be a mix of both. So one of the things that I think came across very powerfully in the course of the transition from military rule to democracy, you know, part of the fourth wave in African countries, and I think this is not, we haven't spoken enough about this, is the role that American diplomats played in reaching out to the media, you know, and, you know, coordinating with civil society groups in different African countries. The United States has done excellently in that regard. It should continue to do more in that regard. So that's number one. But the other thing is, you know, the transnational connections between, you know, civil society groups in the United States and civil society groups in Nigeria and other African countries. Again, that has been there. It needs to be strengthened for, you know, and scrutinized for areas of weakness. But we can continue to, you know, fight those fights broadly on those two fronts.
I want to go back to the issue of what government should do, Ebenezer, and particularly in the context of the consequences of the Russian invasion of Ukraine. There has been a lot of talk about how the invasion is going to have a ripple effect, that it is going to increase food insecurity in particular, and also help exacerbate the problems that many countries face with their debt loads, particularly in the global south, as you referred to it before. What is it, if anything, you think the West should be doing to help African countries prepare for what may be for them quite a destructive ripple effect from the Russian invasion?
I'm going to surprise you by saying probably as little as possible, and there's a reason I'm saying that.
Okay.
There's an opportunity here too. So let's push African countries just a little bit. There's an opportunity here too for African countries, you know, to take advantage of the situation, you know, that is unfolding in the aftermath of the Ukraine conflict. Now, African countries have relied on imports from Russia and Ukraine, you know, wheat, all kinds of produce and all of that. So we get that. And the supply is going to slow down or cease completely because of this situation. But 60% of arable land in the world is still currently in Africa. There's tremendous opportunity for African countries to take their own destiny in their own hands. If you can't import wheat from Ukraine anymore, there's plenty of land in Africa for African countries to do their own farming. So if there is anything at all that I think, maybe to return to your question, that the United States or Western countries can assist with, it is helping private entrepreneurs to invest in agriculture in Africa. There is just so much land, so much opportunity in Africa, you know, to produce food food, not just for African countries, but to feed other parts of the world. For me, that's the direction in which I want to go. I don't want African countries to be saddled with more debt. I don't want African countries to go abhorring simply because of, the pain they are suffering from the Ukrainian conflict. I want them to be very realistic, to look very closely at what's going on and say, look, we can turn this apparent disadvantage into advantage by taking our destiny into our own hands and making sure that for the long term, we no longer rely on the countries that we've relied on for something as basic as food production.
Sounds, Ebenezer, like you have a topic or two for your next blog post.
I do. Thank you very much.
On that note, I'm going to close up the President's Inbox for this week. My guest has been Ebenezer Obidari. Ebenezer is the Douglas Dillon Senior Fellow for Africa Studies here at the Council on Foreign Relations. Ebenezer, as always, pleasure to chat.
Thank you, Jim. Thank you for having me.
We're going to have you back on. We're going to do a deep dive on Nigeria, okay?
Okay. Thank you, sir.
Please subscribe to the President's Inbox on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen, and leave us a review. They help us get noticed and improve the show. You can find the books and articles mentioned in this episode, as well as a transcript of our conversation on the podcast page for the President's Inbox on CFR.org. As always, opinions expressed in the President's Inbox are solely those of the host or our guests, not of CFR, which takes no institutional positions on matters of policy. Today's episode was produced by Zoe Collis with senior producer Jeremy Sherlock. Zoe did double duty as our recording engineer. As always, Zoe, thank you very much. Special thanks go out to Margaret Gatch for her assistance. This is Jim Lindsay. Thanks for listening.